Okay, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the chance to gather tonight to think about some things that are really important and will impact us and our children and maybe generations beyond. And so, Father, I'm asking for your help tonight. I'm praying that you would help us to hear what is true and wise from your word and to think deeply and profoundly about it. I'm praying you'd help us to sift out human opinion from eternal truth, both in the things that are shared by me and in our own and in each of our thoughts as we think and process those things. Help us to know the difference between what is wheat and what is chaff. Let your word be the standard. Let your word be sufficient in our own hearts. And Father, I pray that you would use tonight to help make us faithful parents, faithful grandparents, faithful helpers of parents, faithful in all the things that you have for us. And I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so tonight we are looking at specific issues, goals, methods as they pertain to the 5 to 12 age group. So last time we looked at the 0 to 5 age range, and tonight we're looking at issues that are specific to the childhood phase, we could say 5 to 12 age group. It's a little intimidating for me to do this because we have three kids in this age group, and so I feel somewhat less confident in some of the things that I feel less confident in my knowledge and experience, but which is hopefully a helpful reality that will just orient us back to the sufficiency of God's word and not human opinion. And then just the plan for the next few weeks or the next few sessions here. So next month in March, we're going to look at teenagehood. I'm going to be really out of my depth there, but I think there's some good resources we can pull on. And again, we've all been teenagers, and so that says something. We know what it's like to be on the inside of that. The month after, we plan to look at parenting adults and grandparenting specifically. And then the final week in May, final session, we want to look at just very specifically the way in which parenting shapes us and changes our hearts. God's aim in parenting as it pertains to our own sanctification. And there's some of that has no doubt been pointed to or alluded to, but we want to really focus on that. So tonight we're looking at the 0 to 5 age range. The 5 to 12 age group. Now, a big topic that we talked about A big topic we looked at last session had to do with obedience, and though we had talked about it before, the idea that with the 0 to 5 age group, we're training our children to obey all the way the first time without complaining was one of the ideas. And I know that some people struggled with that idea, because kids struggle with that idea. Kids struggle with obeying without complaining. And I know that we struggle with that. And together with that is sort of the idea that grace, and I think this is an idea that's impacted all of us to one extent or another, is that grace involves some measure of permission to sin. And so if we apply that to our parenting, being gracious with our kids implies there's some leeway they have to sin, and it's okay. And I think that we really I want to just revisit that, and then it's going to segue into what we're looking at tonight. I think we need to see that training our kids to obey all the way the first time without complaining, training them to do that, is grace. And part of where I get that from is Titus 2, the grace of God has appeared, training us to renounce worldly passions and to live upright and godly lives in the present age. Grace trains us to do what's right. There's a story, and I've referenced this in sermons before, my mom told when I was a child. I heard this story many, many times, and it was a missionary story of a missionary who was in a jungle or tribal remote environment with his family, and he walked in the room and his son was lying on the bed and right above him was a very poisonous snake. And so he walks in the door, and he sees this, and he says, "Son, don't move." And if his son had said, had got up and said, "Why?" he would have been dead. And so the fact that that child had been trained to obey instantly saved his life. And so therefore, training the child to obey instantly all the way the first time was an act of grace from the parent. I heard that story a lot, and that shows what kind of an obeyer I was as a child, but I think it's a helpful story. There's another story, again, you've probably heard me share this, about the... And there's all kinds of other issues going on here, no doubt. I'm not sidelining those, but of a 12-year-old boy playing with the fake gun, the police tell him to drop it, he doesn't drop it, they can't tell it's a real gun, they open fire. They can't tell it's not a real gun, they open fire, and he dies. And the fact that if, now again, there's maybe all kinds of other issues there, but a factor is that if he had obeyed when the officers told him to obey, he would far more likely still be alive, as far as I understand the story. And so it's that idea that training our kid to obey all the way the first time without complaining and talking back is grace because of the benefits that it brings in their life. You just think about your kid running out into traffic, right? And you say, "Stop." And them responding immediately might be the difference between life and death. And when I say immediately, I mean, you know what I mean? Like there's, realistically, but them not saying, "Why do I have to stop?" as they keep running. But no, a child who, when you say stop, they stop and they say, okay. Maybe a more biblical example of this all was think of Israel being told by God to go into the promised land. And what do? They obey. They're ready to go into the promised land after dragging their feet, complaining, threatening to go back. So, you know, and then they get punished, and then they're ready to go into the promised land. But by then it's too late, and it's 40 years in the wilderness. And the fact that they eventually got ready to obey after a whole bunch of stuff isn't the issue. The fact is that when God told them, "Go in and take the land," they said no, and there were serious consequences of that. And we might hear that and think, well, that's old covenant, that's Old Testament. But listen to these words from 1 Corinthians 10. And what these words from 1 Corinthians 10 open up is the fact that God's journey, or Israel's journey in the wilderness with the Lord, and God's journey with them, we can say that, is very fertile material for us to learn a lot about what it means to interact with the Lord today. So even though there's a covenantal difference, we're in the new covenant. Listen to these words from 1 Corinthians 10, this is 5 to 6. "Nevertheless, with most of them God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did." And then down in verse 9, "We must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble, as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come." So that means that Israel's story is a place that we can take our children and say, look what happened to them when they complained about what God gave them. Like, with some of our children, the eating issues, we've gone to the manna and the complaining passages, maybe not as often as we should, but I think often enough to talk about the fact that, look, this is what God has provided for you, and we need to receive it with thankfulness. But all of this, I think, emphasizes the importance of obedience. So don't just take it from me. Look at Israel and Moses and learn the lessons that God means for us to listen, or God means for us to learn. And yet, with all of that being said, there is a shift that takes place as we move from the 0 to 5 range into the 5 to 12 age range when it comes to obedience. And I think there are, what do I have here? 1, 2, 3, 4 ways that I think a transition happens as we move from 0 to 5 to 5 to 12. And these overlap. They're not perfectly distinct. Basically, the way in which all of this could be summed up is we want our kids to think and not just be robots. When they are two, they need to know, Dad said no, you stop. As they grow and as they mature, we want them to be able to think and process and interact and grow in more ways than simply responding to obedience. Not that we're throwing that aside, but we're building on that foundation. So here's four kind of ways in which that matures. One is appealing respectfully. So for example, with a two-year-old or a three-year-old, you know pretty much what's going on in their life and in their world because it's all kind of pretty small and it's right there. And if you say put the toy down, then they need to put the toy down. With an 8 or a 9 year old, particularly if they've got school or things like that going on, and with two parents, you might tell them, well, this kind of thing happens all the time. I might say to one of our kids, can you please fill up the cat dish? Now, they may have just been told by another parent, can you go do this? Or maybe they're just in the middle of something, and maybe they're working on an assignment, or maybe they had hoped to go do something right away, and so I see a kid just sitting there and think, well, you can fill up the cat dish right now, but there's things that I don't know. And so it's appropriate for a child as they age to be able to appeal to a command and say, Dad, I was just going to go do this. Do you mind if I fill up the cat dish after I do that? That's not disobedience. That's just thinking and respectful interaction. And of course, a two-year-old doesn't do that, but by the time they're 12, that kind of thing happens a lot. We want to teach them to do that respectfully, though, right? And to not just talk back and whatever. But that idea of respectfully, you could say appealing or just interacting with our directions and instructions, there's still a willingness to obey right away, but there's an awareness that there's more going on than just our instructions to them, and so for them to be able to say, Dad, do you mind if I do that after I do this? Or Dad, could I ask you a question about that? Respectful appealing is, we know a family that taught their kids to actually have like a, what was the specific phrase? Was it like, can I appeal that decision or something? Like it seemed awfully formal, and I respect the heart behind that. I think it can be a bit more natural. Just, Dad, can I ask you a question about that? Or do you mind if I do that first? And so, does that kind of make sense? You want to interact with that or ask questions about that? Or just that idea of respectful interaction, respectful appealing, is not opposite of obedience. It kind of fits with it. The second has to do with not micromanaging our children as we give them instructions and as we expect them to obey. Not micromanaging every little part of what they do. And this is where this is coming from, is the idea that as they move through childhood, we are wanting to prepare them for the next stage. We're wanting to prepare them for adolescence. We're wanting to prepare them for adulthood. And we expect that with a 2 or a 3 year old, they're going to need to be told, or even a 4 or 5 year old, do this and then do this and then do this and then do this. But as they grow, we want to not micromanage. We want to be able to give them an instruction, but then allow them the space to figure out how best to fulfill those instructions themselves and to give them space to do that. I think this is really important as we're training our kids to think and not just to be, punch card robots. So as we might say to them, could you... There are some things that they're going to need more step-by-step instructions with. And as parents, you're going to figure that stuff out as your kids get older. For example, if their room is a total mess and you say, go clean your room, I mean, we know what that's like as adults, right? Like when the kitchen or the house or the garage is a mess and you walk in and you're just like, what in the world? But by now we've hopefully learned some skills of how to break it down into smaller groups and okay, I'm gonna start with the workbench and then I'm gonna, but to kids it can be overwhelming. So there's some things even in childhood that, even later childhood, that we're gonna have to help them kind of take a big project and break it down into bite-sized pieces. You know, if you send them to clean their room and an hour later nothing's happened, it might not be disobedience. It might be that their brain is just completely overwhelmed and they need some help breaking it down into pieces that they're able to accomplish or achieve. But there's other jobs where it's important for them, or not just jobs, but just experiences, where it's really important for them to learn to think for themselves and begin to problem solve and try things and show ingenuity. This is something that kids in the modern world don't get near as many options or chances to do as, you know, think of a farm kid. Well, I got to spend a year on a farm and it was an amazing experience. And you got to just do stuff and build stuff and try stuff and try and fail. And I remember trying to build a go-kart with my friends when I was 10 and it didn't work, but I learned a lot about stuff through that process. And so I think it's important as we give instructions to our kids to think about areas where we don't micromanage, and we say, okay, can you do this? And they say, well, what? Say, you figure it out. I want you to figure out how best to do this. But you do this. Here's an interesting benefit, as just this comes from my experience, is as I have, as I've tried to do this with our older kids in particular, I've realized that as I give them enough instruction that they know what to do, but I also give them space to figure out how to do that, I'm also training them how to interpret the Bible. And you might go, whoa, that just came out of left field. But think about the fact that God has told us some things in His Word, but not everything in His Word. So God has told us, for example, big picture, what marriage is supposed to look like. He hasn't told us how to ask a girl out on a date. He's told us, you know, he's told dads to, through the instructions to elders, to manage their households well. But he hasn't told us what to look like and, you know, what software to use to organize your home maintenance tasks, right? Like, or finances or whatever. And yet there are other areas where I think God has told us a fair bit more than we think if we pay careful attention to what He actually said. I think in His Word, God has packed way more in there than we get at a first read if we just really pay attention. And so I know this has happened a number of times with my kids, and I'm the specific examples are failing me, but let me try and make something up. I might say to Asher, can you take all the cardboard on the deck and put it in the recycling bin? And a minute later, he might say, Dad, this piece of cardboard too? And what's easy to say is, yes. But the kind of thing that I've tried to do, and so your mileage may vary, this is just something I've learned, just almost kind of stumbled into by accident, is I'll say, Asher, think about what I said to you. And so I'm not saying this with annoyance, like, what did I say to you? But just like trying to help him think. So Asher, what did I say to you? He said, well, take all the cardboard. I said, so if I said all the cardboard on the deck, do you think that includes that piece? Yes. Okay, so then do it. And as we do that, we're sort of helping them think, but we're also helping them think about words and actually apply some skills that we apply to interpreting the Bible on a pretty regular basis. So this is, again, something I kind of stumbled into, and I'll tell you in 5-10 years how well it goes. You know, in terms of how well do my kids interpret the Bible in 5 to 10 years. I'm in the journey here, in the process. But again, we don't want just obeyers. We want thinkers, and that leads to the third point. The third point is throughout the 5 to 12 age group, we want to begin to emphasize character instead of just obedience. Again, this is all building on obedience. You're saying, why are you downplaying obedience after talking about it so much? There's a foundation, and we're building on that foundation here. And this idea of character instead of just obedience, we've talked about this before, but it really becomes clear in this age group. And this has to do with the issue of addressing the heart. Let me give an example, and this I think this example comes from Ted Tripp's book. If you've got two kids in the back seat, and one of them has a roll of Lifesavers, and they're just popping them in their mouth one after the other, and the kid beside them is saying, give me one," and the other kid is saying, "No, not going to give you one, not going to. They're mine." You have two options. Well, you probably have more than two, but there's two. One is to just issue a command. Give some Lifesavers to your brother. And if you've trained your kids to obey, they'll do that. Okay, Dad said, I'm going to do it. I mean, connected to that, you could invent a rule for your household. We share Lifesavers with our brothers and sisters. So if you have 10 in a package, you must give 5 to them. You could give a rule, okay, which would just be a way of perpetuating that command. But what happens if all you do is give that command and you leave it there? What are you not addressing? You're not addressing their heart. You're not addressing their character. When they're sitting there popping Lifesavers in their mouth one after the other and ignoring their brother or sister, is that an obedience issue? It's not an obedience issue. They're not disobeying any command you gave them, unless you give them a command. But that's a character issue. That's a selfishness issue. That's them thinking about themselves more than they're thinking about others. And so if you just apply a command, give them some Lifesavers, that's just a Band-Aid. And they should obey. And you might, even after talking about all the important stuff, you might still have to give a command. They should obey. But especially as they move through this age group, you want to ask questions like, who are you thinking of right now? Right? Who's more important right now? What's more important, that the candy or your brother, you know, or your sister? Like, you want to ask them questions to, or just not just asking questions. There's going to be things that you're going to say that are going to help them begin to understand and grow in their character, focusing on the heart. Ted Tripp, in his book Shepherding a Child's Heart, talks a lot about addressing the conscience and sort of asking questions that make them go, oh yeah, right? They've got a conscience, right? And so a question like, who are you thinking about more here, yourself or your brother or sister? Hopefully gives them a moment to pause and reflect and go, oh yeah. Who is made in the image of God, those Lifesavers or your brother or sister here? And so helping them to reflect. We talked about this character formation piece about, you know, the book of Proverbs being given to us for this purpose, to help us train our children in character, and reading through the Proverbs. This year we've started reading through a Proverbs devotional by Tim Keller, and it's above the kids' level, so I have to translate a fair bit, but it's bringing us through the Proverbs very slowly and thoroughly, and it's allowing us to talk about some of this character stuff. But in the moment, we need to think, is just a command, is that really what this situation needs? Or do we need to do the harder thing of addressing their heart, addressing their character, and helping them see to the real issues beneath the surface? A command is easy. Give them some Lifesavers. Taking some time to help them really understand what's going on is more time consuming and more challenging, but it's really important. Of course, as we do this, if we help our kids understand the sin in their heart and then just leave it there, that's a pretty heavy burden to be strapping onto their back. So we need to be bringing them again and again to the cross and reminding them of the gospel, reminding them of the power of God to change their hearts, the grace of God to forgive them and transform them. And I don't say that as a parent who thinks that he does that amazingly well or as consistently as I should. This is something Amy and I have just been talking about recently, is wanting to remember and just reflecting on the times where we haven't done that. And so again, hear me speaking here as a fellow traveler. but we want to orient them to the gospel. And I'll say a word here. This is kind of a slight rabbit trail, but there's a lot of parents who have a really big priority of their kid getting saved. And, you know, just sort of like getting their kid to that moment where their kid asks Jesus into their heart. And typically this happens in this age group, okay? This often happens 4, 5, 6. Oh, good, they asked Jesus into their heart. Whew, we're fine. Okay, I think that's a pretty thin understanding of the gospel and how the gospel works. I remember hearing a story about someone who, you know, we're talking about heaven and hell. This is a 5 or 6-year-old, and they didn't want to go to heaven, or they didn't want to go to hell, and they want to go to heaven. Well, how'd you do that? Well, Jesus died for you. And you ask him in your heart, okay. And so they prayed the prayer, they asked him in their heart, the parents had a party. And then like that same night, they brought something up and this person about being bad. And this person's like, I'm not bad, I'm a good person. How much did you understand the gospel, right? And so I think it's very important that the gospel and the good news of Jesus gets baked into everything we're doing. Now, for your kids, there may come a moment where it's the moment, and for other kids, it may be, and just, you know, some kids, like, I don't assume that our kids are going to come, just because they're in a Christian home, that they're going to come to faith. Some people would criticize me for that, but I think it's likely, it's very likely, there's a high, it seems like one of the ways that God likes to draw people to himself is by giving them a Christian parent. That's one of the ways that God tends to do this. And so it's not wrong to expect that. I mean, he gave you kids and told you to bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And though I'm not a Presbyterian who believes there's this, you know, big covenantal promise there, I do think it's something that we should hopefully expect and pray for. But if not demand, we don't demand it. That being said, some kids are going to come to faith at a clear moment of faith far later on, some far earlier on. For some kids, it might be a moment, and for some kids, it may just be a growing realization. So it was very strange for me to have my two sons both be baptized at the age that they were. I was not expecting that, and was actually fairly uncomfortable with that. And with one of those sons, there was a clear moment where he knew, like, this is when I started asking Jesus to be my king. And with the other kid, it was more of a growing awareness, and we couldn't exactly point to the moment, but it just, this is what he believed. And when you ask him the questions and you see the fruit in his life, insofar as you can see that with his young childlike faith, it's there. And so I encourage you to not put the pressure on your kids to pray the prayer and ask Jesus into their heart. So then, okay, good, they're saved and we're good now. But understand that we really, I think as parents, have a really hard time understanding their growth in the gospel when true faith happens. Does it happen when they're 5? Does it happen when they're 17 after they've come back to the Lord after a hard year or two? Does it happen when they're, like, just teach them the gospel, and I think we leave it up to the Lord to decide and to know when they pass from death to life. And of course, that gets into questions of baptism and all of that. That we maybe if we have time at the end, we could talk about that. But as we address their hearts and all of that, we want to just not just leave them with, oh, I'm a sinner again, you know. But lead them to the cross. Okay, so we've looked at three things. There's a fourth. So we talked about kind of appealing or interacting with your instructions in a respectful way. Not micromanaging was the second one. The third one was emphasizing character and their heart instead of just obedience. The fourth is kind of similar to the second one, but this involves carefully, because we want to be careful here, but carefully inviting their input on family matters. Now, this is not something that would have immediately been obvious to me, because this was not a case in the home that I grew up in. But my mentor talked to me about this as we were talking about some vacation plans and some things we were going to do. And he said, Chris, your kids are old enough. Why don't you ask them what they think? And not that we're putting the decision-making power right in their hands, but that we are showing them that what they think matters and is important, and we want to know what they think. So I feel hesitant here, because I know some parents do this way too much. You know, they'll say to their kids, you know, what do you want to wear today? And then they'll spend half an hour as their kids are like, I want to wear that, that, and that. And you're like, oh, you can't wear that. And I've just asked them, and it's like, or it's like, so what do you want for supper tonight? Well, I want, you know, this. It's like, actually, we can't have that. I shouldn't have asked you that question. So we need wisdom as we apply this. And I think there are ways in which parents can seriously overuse this, but I think it's also possible to underuse this. And so we want to train our kids to think. We want to train our kids to have opinions on things, to not just be, you know, just, oh, mom and dad said that, so that's that. And here's the thing. Our kids will have opinions on things. And so we might as well, you know, give them a space to share what those are and to ask questions and of them, so that they feel comfortable expressing their opinions to us and as we invite them in. So here's another way of just talking about this is that we want to train our kids, as we think about all the ways that we're training them, we want to train them how to make decisions, and how to make decisions well. And one of the ways that we can do that is by inviting them into family decision-making processes. And this doesn't come very naturally to me. Like I said, I've needed to learn this, and I'm still kind of stumbling my way through it. But I think it's important. I definitely believe it's important. So we're about to move on to another big topic, but these are four ways that the discussion on obedience, I think, shifts and matures as our kids go through the 5 to 10 5 to 12 age group. I want to just look something up quickly here. I want to draw it on the board here, but I want to make sure I get it right. There's a chart that Ted Tripp gives in Shepherding a Child's Heart that helpfully illustrates this sort of transition that we're talking about, and as it continues over into the teenage years, is we're kind of in many ways setting them up for teenagehood, which is another way of saying we're setting them up for adulthood. Okay, yeah, here it is. Okay, so I'll draw this chart here. Okay, let me try to explain this here. These two lines represent the authority that we have over our children compared to the influence that we have over our children as that changes over time. And so the idea is that at age zero, the authority we have is really big, but in terms of influence, like, you're not... I mean, objectively, you're influencing your kids. But you even think of like a one-year-old or a two-year-old. Like, they're not thinking, I wonder what my dad thinks about this. That would be amazing if they did. But so that's a part of what we're thinking about influence, is like them welcoming our influence on their character, on their personhood. And so in the early stages, we have lots of authority, but in terms of influence, which there's going to be ways of defining that. We're going to talk about this chart more specifically in our next session. But as we get towards adulthood, our direct authority, our ability to say, do this because I said so, even though we want to really save the because I said so, but our ability to say that goes way down to the point where it's not there. Like as an adult, your parent can't say to you, do this because I said so. But hopefully by that point, our parents' influence is pretty high, that when our parent says, you know, that would be a really good car for you to buy, hopefully that means a lot. If our parents say, that'd be a really good person for you to think about being in a relationship with, hopefully that means an awful lot. And so on. So you kind of hear what I'm saying here as we think about influence and authority. And so as we move through these childhood ages, we're already being aware of the fact that our authority is not operating the same way it was in these early years. But hopefully our influence is growing. And I hope that that's happening as I'm on the journey, as I invite my kids into decisions and discussions and ask what they think and so on. And I'm still learning this and not doing it perfectly, but I think this is worth thinking about and considering. So before we move on to the next kind of big topic, any thoughts or feedback here about some of these shifts in the obedience issue over the 5 to 12 age group? You can all hear me just swallowing, just nice and clear, hey? You're welcome. Yeah.
So if you're in a position where you're, say, struggling with authority, how do you swap it back to influence? Like, what are the steps to take to switch that around?
So here's... So that's a hard question to answer.
At an older age, I'm saying.
Sorry?
At an older age, I'm saying.
At an older age, yeah. That's a hard question to answer in the abstract. I mean, like, without knowing what's the real specific situation going on. Notice even here, here's part of what I would want to say about this chart and how it's not absolutely perfect. I think this here is talking about functional authority. In other words, how much you use your authority. This line, if we were to draw a line of actual authority, it would be like, and then like at adulthood when they move out of the house, it's like that, right? So when a kid is 17 and a half and they're still living at home under your roof and you say, no, you may not take my car out tonight, they may not take your car out tonight. So your actual authority is still there. But hopefully you're at the point in their relationship where you don't have to say that to them, because they're saying, hey, Dad, do you think it would be a good idea for me to take the car out tonight? Or, Dad, do you mind? You say, well, what do you have to do tomorrow? Well, I have, or like, what school? Well, I've got a big assignment due tomorrow. And you kind of look at them and they go, yeah, I probably should work on that tonight. Hey, do you think that would be a good idea? Yeah, it probably would be. Okay, right? So you have a relationship with them where you don't have to say, you're not taking the car out. You have influence over them that is bring them to that spot. Now, what I've just described is maybe a fantasy. I hope that kind of thing happens when my kids are teenagers. That's the goal. But I think that the ways that we build that influence with them is by engaging them as far back as we can in a good, healthy relationship where they know they're loved, they know we care about them, they know we're listening to them, they know that they matter. We're showing our heart and our care for them. We're explaining the decisions we're making. We're investing in them. We're spending time with them. And it's not too late. I was talking to someone recently who has a child who's an adult and has children of their own, and they're realizing that they don't really have the influence in this child's life that they wish they did. And as we talk together, what we sort of help see together and I encourage them with is that it's not too late, but just to spend time with their child and let their adult child, I mean, it's an adult, but still their child, know that they matter to you and that you love them and you're listening to them and you hear them and you care about them and you care for them, and that as you invest just in that person, in that relationship, Lord willing, that's going to have a softening effect on their heart, and they're going to start to care more about what you think about things and care more about your opinion and your perspective and want to spend time with you, and that influence grows. That kind of help? There's so much more we could say there about the specific things, no doubt. We'll come back to this. We're going to make a shift here to another topic that is pretty big in the 5 to 12 age group. So we've talked about obedience and this transition. We're going to talk about education. How about education? And when I talk about education, I'm not talking about school, although we're also going to talk about school. What does Ephesians 6:2 say that dads, and of course by extension, dads and moms, are to bring their child up in? Discipline and instruction of the Lord. And those words taken together, so we talked about this two or three months ago, those words taken together point to a comprehensive worldview, training, a comprehensive education. When we think of the word education, we very unfortunately often think about going to school and learning your ABCs and your 1, 2, 3s. That's education. The biblical vision is that education is a whole life development in a whole worldview, a whole understanding of the world and of God and of yourself and of others. And it is comprehensive. So the dichotomy that we often have is, so let me kind of draw it here. See, I knew as soon as I did this, I was going to use it more than I thought. So we think of, let's say, character formation. I was going to write character formation. We might think of spiritual development. This would be like understanding the gospel and things like that. This would be church involvement. Characters like learning how to work hard and use money well and not be lazy. And then we might think of education. So that'd be like the ABCs and the 1, 2, 3s. We might think of these as being separate little bubbles. The biblical vision is that there's one whole big unit here. Education. / character development. / spiritual development. And this whole big thing is called the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Now again, you can break it down. And we did look at some of the particular nuances of character and some of the particular nuances some of the particular nuances of discipline and some of the particular nuances of instruction. So those two words are used there on purpose, and they do point to different things. But taken together, we've got this whole big thing called the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And so ABCs and 1, 2, 3s and Bible reading and knowing how to work hard and not be lazy, and knowing how not to fight with your brother and sister, it's all a part of this whole big thing. So how do we know that? How do we say that? Well, we know that from these words that Paul uses in Ephesians 6, and the way in which those were used prior to that. I said 6:2. It's actually 6. It's not verse 2, right? That's verse 4? Or is it verse 2? It's verse 4, Ephesians 6:4. That's what I thought. The way in which these words were used and understood in Judaism and that whole background, If we go back to ancient Israel, they did not have schools. So just so you know, I'm not about to launch into an argument for homeschooling. I'm just giving you a historical reality. There were no schools in ancient Israel until much later on in their history. The home is where children were trained and where children were educated. And you look at the book of Proverbs, which in many ways is kind of a manual for the training of young people. What you see there is that there's an assumption that practical skills are going to be learned as kids worked with their moms and dads. They're going to learn how to bake bread. They're going to learn how to kill a cow and butcher it. They're going to learn how to do all that kind of stuff as they work with their moms and dads. And the formation of character happens as their dads teach them. And we see this thing in Proverbs. We see this thing in Deuteronomy 6. And it's all comprehensive. And it all is under the banner of Yahweh. You live in Yahweh's world and in his particular country with this particular chosen people, and it was all there. And it is really unfortunate that many modern parents see education and the other stuff as two totally different things. So I train at home, I train my kids on spiritual stuff and character stuff, and then the government takes my kids for 5 or 6 hours a day to give them an education. Like that's a very modern idea with some actually pretty dangerous background to it. Now again, please hear what I'm saying. Tonight is not about, so just so you know where I'm going here. Tonight is not about telling everyone they need to homeschool. So that's not where I'm going. But we do need to think critically about public school. We do need to think critically about public school, particularly if parents are thinking about it in this way. You educate my kids for 6 hours so I don't have to. Part of what I'm saying here, we're going to emphasize this at the end, is that education as this whole thing is a parent's responsibility. So what happens at school from 8:45 to 3:30 or 3:15 or whatever it is, man, it's so funny. I used to like, when you're a kid in public school, like, the end of the day felt like, finally. And now it's like, they're getting out already? Like, there's still so many hours left in the day. Anyways, 3:15 is not the same as it used to be. But that is a part of this, and parents are responsible for it. Parents are responsible to know and to be a part of what's going on in those hours if that's what they do with their kids. So if there's a public school or let's do public school component, that's a part of this, and it's part of the parents' responsibility. Let's talk about just some of the particular dangers just of public school, which I think any parent, particularly those who have their kids in public school, need to be aware of. So I think if we were to talk more recently, what are some of the issues today that have parents concerned about public school?
Indoctrination,
okay. On what kinds of issues? Where do you start, right? Evolution?
Yeah, evolution. Identity.
Right, sexual identity. Kids in Nipawin are being taught the gender-bred man, right? So that's...
The gender-bred
man. Just look it up. It's this way. I think it's grade 6 is where they're being taught this, and it's this idea. They're basically being taught, you know, gender is a spectrum, and some people express it this way, and some people express it this way, and teaching and encouraging that fluidity is okay, and you can be a boy in a girl's body and a girl in a boy's body, and there's all these different ways to be boys and all these different ways to be girls, and so it's pretty, just look up gender. They draw it like a gingerbread man, but it's the gender-bred man. Just Google it. And so I mean, kids in Nipawin in grade 6 are at least were being given this. The Saskatchewan Teachers Federation, their policy manual has that they need to be teaching and promoting things like the gay-straight alliances. It's in the STF manual. So every teacher in Saskatchewan has to be part of the STF. And the manual, it's not written like these are things you have. Like, it's not written like dictates, but these are their beliefs. They're called beliefs. And so they share these beliefs in, you know, the whole gender spectrum and all of that. So, I knew this was coming down the pipe years ago when I was the young adults pastor in Regina, and I had students in the education program coming and talking to me and just being like, okay, we're being told we have to teach this stuff. There's some other, I mean, indoctrination, let's just talk about like the self. I'm just going to write self. And what I mean by that is you can be whoever you want to be, you can do it, you're awesome, you're this, you're that, like a view that would sort of put you at the top. And that actually gets into what we're going to talk about in just the next couple of minutes here. I'll just ask you guys. We're going to break here very soon, by the way. But what are some other kind of public school concerns?
Harassment and bullying.
So I had written down here, but this is better. I had playground stuff, but that's that playground stuff and locker room stuff. Absolutely. I was significantly bullied in public school. It took me years to get over it. Someone very close to me was bullied so badly that in junior high they were at the point of suicide. I mean, that's just real. So yeah, harassment and bullying, very true.
That influences how you feel.
Okay, right. Yeah. How many people, their first exposure to things like pornography and stuff like that comes from you know, friends and things that happen in that kind of environment. I learned how to swear in grade 4. Well, I learned how to swear in grade 3, actually, from kids on the playground. So those are all things. Here's what I think the greatest problem. Because I do think there's a problem with public school. And again, I'm not saying every parent has to homeschool, I think, but we have to correctly identify what some of the problems are so we can know how to address them. I think the greatest problem is the absence of God. And I don't just mean that you do your math and your science and your history and your language arts and then you have a Bible class, and if we could just get the kids praying in school again, that would be fine. That's actually not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is what's missing is God, in the sense of children being trained to know that this is God's world that we live in. That math and science and art and language and social studies and phys ed are God's things. That math is God's language. God built a world that works on math. Do you know, I could throw this marker at Damien right now, and the exact path of that marker through the air, you could describe in beautiful mathematical formulas on a piece of paper. I mean, I couldn't do it, but a physicist could. It's just, it's beautiful, the math that undergirds our world. This is God's language. Science is we're following God's trail as we discover the fact that he built an orderly world, and all of the founders of modern science, Galileo and Kepler and all these people were Copernicus. They were thinking God's thoughts after him. What was it? Copernicus's title of his book was, you know, an orderly account of the system by which a most excellent creator designed the world. Yeah, something to that effect. These were God-fearing men who understood that an intelligent creator built this place. Let's figure it out. Art reflects God's beauty. God built beauty into the world, and we can see that certain forms of art are not beautiful, and certain forms are, and there's standards and things that we can learn as art reflects the beauty that God has built into his world. Language matters. Why? Because in the beginning was the Word, and God is a speaker and a communicator. God built this plant, this universe, using words. God speaks to us with words. So we want to learn to use words well, so we can understand him, so we can understand each other, so we can communicate his love to other people. Words matter, because God's God matters. Social studies can't be understood apart from a biblical understanding of the heart of man, right? We're learning about Canadian history this year, and as you see the way in which, like, some of the stuff just shocks me, how the British didn't have enough soldiers to win a war against the First Nations tribes, so they sent them cloths deliberately infected with smallpox, telling them it was medicine to kill them off so that they could have an easier chance of winning. It's, how can you understand that and explain that apart from understanding Genesis 3 and our lust for power, and yet to also see through history God directing things, and it's His story. It's not just a cheesy cliche. It's actually true. Phys ed matters because these bodies were made and designed by God. Isn't it cool the things that they can do? And we want to take care of them because we want to take care of these bodies well that God has given us. And just even the whole big picture, why do we learn these things? Why do we learn math and language and science? And why do we want to do well on our tests? And why do we want to do that? What's the answer the world's going to give you to those questions? Why should I do well at school? Some kid goes to his guidance counselor and says, why should I do well at school? What are the answers he's going to be given?
So they can be whatever they want to be when they grow up?
That's right. So you can be successful. So you can get a good job wherever you want to get a good job. So you can make as much money as you want. So you can get the house that you want. So you can just be whoever you want to be. Whereas, what's the biblical answer to these things? We want to learn these things and do these things because this is God's world and this is God's truth. And working hard is one of the ways that we show love for Him and one of the ways that we glorify Him. And we, you know, as we work hard at a math test, we're thinking God's thoughts after Him, and we're helping to understand this world, and we're developing our minds. Our minds are growing and learning, so that we can use our minds to love Him and love others. As we learn language, we're learning that so that we can use that language to love God and love others. And so this education is a, you see, you're part of what I'm saying now, right? Is the ABCs and the 1-2-3s is a part of this whole big thing. And so if we think that it's over here, We're encouraging our kids to believe a lie, right? To believe that math is just a thing that exists independent of God is a lie. That language is just a thing, or science is just a thing out there. That you can approach math or science or history neutral, totally neutral, without thinking about God, that's a lie. When you pick up math, you're picking up God's thing. And so if someone says, oh, we're just going to approach this with just being totally neutral, we don't have to talk about God, that's like someone walking into my house and I'm like, hey, this is, oh, no, we're just not going to talk about the homeowner. You know, we're just going to be totally neutral here. We're just in this neutral space of, it's called the living room, and we see there's a couch, and I'm meanwhile the whole time being like, oh, this is my house. Okay, that's what's going on as we talk about math and language, and you know, we're just going to be neutral, not going to bring any religious stuff into it. And meanwhile, it's as if, and of course God's not doing this, but it's as if God would be saying, this is mine. This is my world that you're in. This is my world you're learning about. And so if we do these things without referencing God, we're lying. And we are training our kids. Here's the really important thing. If we just do the public school thing, and again, I think it's possible, I'm going to talk about this after we break here, but if we just think, okay, you go get your education, that's great, you come home, we kind of just do your tests, whatever, and then we'll read you a Bible story before bed. We're training our kids to divide up the world into God stuff and non-God stuff. And where's that going to lead them? If there's parts where it's like, oh, well, God just doesn't apply to that. God doesn't apply to math. God doesn't apply to science. God doesn't apply to school. God doesn't apply to my relationship with that new person that I met and that I want to hop into bed with. Or God doesn't apply to my desire to buy this latest thing that I can't afford. And we train our kids to take God out of, or to imagine the lie that there's parts of this world that you can understand without God. Our instruction to bring up our children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord means that we help them see that this is God's world, every last bit of it. Their money in the piggy bank is God's money. The numbers on their sheet are God's numbers. Everything is His. So, this... Okay, we'll take a break here in just half a minute. I need to take a break just because my iPad's going to die, and so is my battery pack is dead too, so I have to grab a cable. But what I've just said is what leads many parents to say, well, I'm going to homeschool my kids so I can just teach them all of this. So here's what's interesting. Amy and I have found that so we've bought homeschool curriculum from a Christian distributor, and it doesn't do all of this work for us. We've got to still, because even with good homeschool Christian curriculum, it's still easy to fall into the pattern of just do your work and then go play, and to not be, like, it takes deliberation on the parents' part to help our kids understand, here's why you need to work hard at this, here's what's going on here, and to help them think everything up to God, and to think God's thoughts after Him, and understand this is God's world, and this is all God's business. Why I don't make this you need to homeschool your kid thing is that I know that there are people for whom that's not an option. I just know that's the case. There are people, so I think there are some people who might say, well, I could, but that would really cramp my style. You know, so who cares? I'll just send my kids off and hope they turn out okay. I know that there are people for whom homeschooling is just not an option. And so that's why I don't come out swinging saying you have to do it. I want to be honest that I regularly pray for the Lord's direction and leading in some kind of Christian education opportunity here in Nipawin, whether that be here at our church or with other churches, the ability to have a Christian school option for people that don't have the option of homeschooling, I think would be awesome. But until the Lord answers that prayer, and there's some specific ways that you could join me in praying for that. Saskatchewan has some pretty tight rules with how to do that kind of stuff, and having someone with a heart for this and an education degree who didn't need to make a lot of money would be really awesome. So if you know anyone. But is it possible for a parent who the situation they're in means their kids going to public school, is it possible for them to still bring up their children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord? I think the answer is yes. There are going to be challenges, no doubt. But it is possible. So we're going to break here. I want you to think, what could a parent whose kid is in public school, or kids are in public school, what are some ways that parent or those parents can still deliberately not just have the ABCs and the 1-2-3s off here by themselves and just be like, okay, fine, go let the world deal with you, but how they can still bring up their children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Let's think about that. Let's talk about that as we come back in 3-4 minutes. So, yeah, there's no doubt the world is shoving this stuff down our throats and using the education system. And this gets to a bigger point, is that public education is... run by who? It's run by the government, right? And so they have agendas, and it's we need to understand in public school there is social engineering going on. That's what it is. It's the government saying, we'll educate your kids. Of course they're going to have a standard. Of course they're going to have certain things that they want to teach and that are convenient for them and so on. So it's just unavoidable. But what are there things that parents can do if they're in a spot where their best option is for their child to be in public school? Are there things that a parent can do? As you've thought about it for a few minutes, what are some of the things that you might suggest?
So me and my daughter, we have a system with her going to public school that We have open lines of communication about everything learned or talked about in school. And if something doesn't seem right or doesn't line up with the Bible for her, then we open the Bible and discuss why it's not proper.
So, Carrie, I think you're reading my notes tonight, because that's the first thing here. Talk about what they're learning, right? Talk a lot about what they're learning and help them think it through. So I love that, that you go to the Bible and you look at it there. So you're helping them think it through. So that's huge. And what you're showing there is that you are interested in what is happening at school. So that's what makes this so dangerous, is when parents are just like, okay, go get your education, that's great. How's your day at school? Awesome, thumbs up, sweet, okay, and then you just move on. But no, to know, like, you know, like, I care about what went on there, and I want to show an active interest in that. And I mean, as sometimes that might be a pretty heavy burden to have to spend all that time unpacking those things, but that's a part of what we do as parents, right? And so we help them think it through. Yeah. Any other thoughts and ideas? I only have two other myself, but any other things from you folks?
Pray for them before they go to school. Pray a hedge of protection over them.
Pray. Yeah.
Maybe have them sit out of certain things, like a certain class, if they're going to be talking about something that's
Yeah, particularly before they're able to process that well. So there's the kind of that choosy, yeah. Growing up, Halloween was one of my favorite days of the year, because we didn't go to school public school that day, because it was just all Halloween parties, and Mom's like, nope. So we would like go shopping with her, and it was awesome. there are some creative ways of doing that, and I mean, I think that's one of the positive things with this, going back to this legislation, is that parents have explicitly legally defined influence in whether their kids participate in sex ed and things like that. So I think that's positive. Here's a suggestion. I guess this really couples off of the other one, which is I think if parents have children who are in public school, to be careful about how many other extracurricular things they pack into their schedules. Particularly, what I'm thinking here is things where the parents aren't able to be involved. Because I think if there's those, you know, 6 or 7 hours a day, that's a big chunk of the day where children are outside from their parents' supervision and authority, and they don't know what's going on. You hope that you're hearing the things, but to know that the influence that you want to have on them is hopefully more than just, you know, 20 minutes at supper time every night. And so if they're in public school, to then have them off here and off here and off here and off here, all without you, each in those places getting influenced by other people and other worldviews and other ideas, your ability to bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord really, really gets diminished. And so I think I would encourage parents who are in a spot where public school is the best choice for them, is to really carefully think through how much else, or if there are other things that their kids are involved in, that the parents are as involved in those things as they possibly can. I think with school, one of the things that used to be an option was for parents to get pretty involved in school. So, you know, like, I don't know if that's still the case, but where you could have all, they want parents to be in the classes and helping the kids read, and, you know, like, there's ways for parents to be involved, and that may not be options for everybody and for every family, but I think there's ways of doing this. I want to be honest here, and I know this is why it's so hard for me, is that I know that there are some people who their options are just not there. And so this is where we want to say, like, I think pretty much all of us here in this room, I don't know if either of you were homeschooled, but I think most of us here went to public school, and here we are, we're serving the Lord. And like, so public school is not a death sentence. Like God is God is big and God is bigger than those things. But there are also many, many Christian kids who went through public school, and through that process it was, you know, the world influenced them a lot more than they had an influence. And so that's why we pray. And God is able to preserve our kids, but I think as our culture gets darker and darker and darker, public school is going to get the same. And so that's why I pray that God would give us some options for how to, whether it's a Christian school or a church-based school, that kind of thing. I think as things progress, there may be some more urgency there as the years go by. But here's the big idea. Parents are responsible for their kids' education, and I think we need to think about it before they get to school age. But I think we want to be training them, thinking about the fact you live in God's world, and yet not everyone else knows that. And we're surrounded by people who are in rebellion to their Creator. We want to love them, but we don't want to believe everything they tell us. And understand this whole thing, that math, science. So as they come home and they're complaining about their homework, I don't want to do math homework. That's our chance to be like, do you know why this is important? This is God's thing. This, you get to love Him and love others by doing that. And we get to really encourage them to see all of life as a creation of God, living in God's world and loving Him and thinking His thoughts after Him as we see a complete education. Let's move on, and if we have time at the end, we can come back to this, but I got basically just three more points tonight, each of which is shorter than these first two. So we're going to talk about something we've already touched on. We're going to talk about gender, we're going to talk about work, and we're going to talk about parenting by praying, rather. Talk about gender here. This, in some ways, this is an unfortunate word, because it would be better to use just the word sex, but of course, if we talk about sex, you think about that other thing, but when I talk about gender, we're talking about being a man, being a woman, being a boy, and being a girl. And the danger with the gender language is that there's this differentiation. So I might have been, someone might say, well, my sex assigned at birth was a boy, but my gender, how I feel and how I express myself is more this. And so that's not what I mean. When I say gender, I mean who God made you to be, right? God picked, because we're creations, we're not creators. And that's what's really the foundational idea here. But it is so important, we touched on this last month, but it's so important that we raise not just children, but we raise future men and future women. We raise boys and we raise girls. And as they go through the 5 to 12 age group, there becomes a lot more of an awareness of what that means. And the differences between boys and girls, and when they're younger, there might not be as big of a difference, but as they get older, those differences manifest themselves more. And so we want to encourage our boys to see that they are boys, and they're gonna be like dad, or, you know, in different ways when they grow up, and that's a good thing. And we want to encourage boys to do boy things, to go fight dragons, even imaginary ones, and to do dangerous things, and to take risks. This is something that's so diminished in the modern world, where everything's hyper-safe, and I'm guilty of this myself. But numbers of years ago, this is 15 or so years ago, there was a book that came out called The Dangerous Book for Boys. Did you hear that or get that? And it was this very old-fashioned, kind of like old British thing, and it shows boys how to build things out of cigar boxes and tells them stories of ancient battles and pictures of how to build a tree house. And it's just good old-fashioned dangerous boy stuff. And I think we really want to teach our boys that. And our modern worlds are so safe. And some of that's unavoidable, you know, because our world is actually not safe. It's dangerous. So we have to create safety for our kids. But we want to train our boys to be boys. And we want to train our girls to be girls. And that means, of course, training them to be brave and courageous, but to express that in particularly feminine ways. Now, that might, for them, that might not include wearing dresses. Maybe they don't want to wear dresses. They might want to wear overalls. But even the ones that wear overalls can be trained to understand that they are not a boy, they are a girl. They're going to grow up not to be a man, but to be a woman. And there are ways of responding to initiative and ways of nurturing leadership that are particularly feminine, and those are beautiful things for them to do. I think it was John Piper that said at the, and this is probably a loose quote, but he says, at the heart of godly masculinity is an inclination to lead, protect, and provide for women in the ways appropriate to their differing relationships. And at the heart of godly femininity is an inclination to nurture, receive, and support leadership from worthy men in ways that are appropriate to their various relationships. And we can teach our kids to do that from a pretty young age, how to respond like a boy and like a girl. Now, I'm going to be honest, I'm out of my depth here in terms of particularly with girls who are struggling with this, because my daughter just naturally loves taking care of her dolls. When I wrestle with the boys, she comes in to care for the wounded. Like, that's just, she just kind of defaults to those things, and they're beautiful. Not everyone will. And so I think there may be ways that a girl who's kind of struggling to figure out her place as a girl may need some help. And I'm out of my depth in that. I think there's places I could point a parent who is struggling with that. I think there's some good resources and places where we could go for help. I've had to push my boys, though, not away from effeminacy, but just away from softness. And I've had to encourage them, like, get outside and get dirty, you know? Like, because they one of them in particular really just enjoys reading, and that's not bad. I mean, that was me when I was his age. But you got a backyard and a treehouse that I built for you, and, like, just go fight some monsters in the backyard with your foam sword and just, you know, do something dangerous. And just this came out recently with the way that the Toronto City Council shut down the sledding hills. Did you see that? Because it's not safe to sled. And so some psychologists spoke up, and they're just talking about the fact, and this goes for boys and girls, like, risky play is good for kids. If you fall out of a tree and break your arm, that doesn't mean you did something wrong. It just means you're a kid. And so it's important that our kids, boys and girls, have that we don't helicopter hover over them, but we give them space where you know, of course, we're not neglecting them, but there's some space for them to take some risks and do some things that are dangerous. I was thinking about this going back to the sermons in the past couple of weeks, thinking about beauty and strength, and that's in some ways what we're talking about. And one of the ways that we have to be careful here is with the media. Our kids are influenced by the media. So if we sit down with our kids and we watch a Disney movie with them, they're influenced by the beauty standards in those movies. You know, like, all the Disney princesses are unrealistically shaped and everything, and their faces and bodies and everything. And so there's very unrealistic beauty standards there. There's unrealistic ways that men and women interact with each other. You know, Prince Charming says this or that, and all of a sudden they're married. And it's like, these things influence our kids. And so as we think about raising them to be men and women and thinking through masculine beauty or masculine strength and feminine beauty, we want to, as we watch media with them, as we introduce that, to very carefully help them think it through. You know, did you see how those two people acted there? What do you think about that? Is that a godly way for a man to treat a woman and vice versa? I've missed opportunities to do this because honestly, sometimes it's just like, you're on to the next thing and they're in bed, but even the next day or two to come back and talk about those things. Teaching little girls, it's okay to want to be pretty, but that true beauty starts within. And teaching boys to recognize and celebrate that. Teaching boys, again, that masculine strength isn't a problem to be solved, but it's a gift to be stewarded. And like we've talked about, training boys to hold the door for girls and women and give up their seat and stand up to bullies to defend the weak and all of those kinds of things. And kind of building this into our family culture and being really careful about media. One final word here, just thinking about gender, is recognizing that when it comes to marriage, we want to give our kids really healthy ideas of marriage. So we want to help them honor marriage. We also want to help them honor singleness, which, according to God, is a gift as well. And so I discourage parents from praying regularly for their child's spouse with their child, because I think that gives an expectation that that spouse exists. They may not. We don't know that, but that's the whole thing, is we don't know. And so I think it's important that we teach our kids, if God wants you to get married, and just that to even be a phrase we use, if God wants you to get married, here's the kind of person that you'd want to look for. Here's the kind of thing you'd want to seek. But God may not want you to get married, and that's good too, and teaching them that. Also recognizing they're learning about marriage as they watch mom and dad. So things like being affectionate in front of our kids is good. And teaching them, talking about marriage in front of the kids so that they learn about it. And not necessarily working through your marriage issues, but I just mean helping give our kids a good sense of these things from a pretty early age, I think is pretty important. So again here, we don't just have children. We've got little boys and little girls, future men and future women. And as they go through the 5 to 12 age group, we really want them to grow into that and to step into that. One more thing here on this, and this is a bit of a hobby horse for me, but in our home, we've made it a thing where we don't tease particularly about crushes and stuff like that. The home that I grew up in, that was a very common thing. When you would notice someone kind of noticing someone else, and it become this whole big thing, and then a kid that just becomes embarrassed about that and internalizes it and doesn't feel comfortable talking about it. And I remember, like, when I was 15, there was a girl I really liked, and when someone in my home found out about that, like, Chris, do you like so and so? And then you just melt inside, and you withdraw to your room, and you try not to see that person. And I dished it out too. I remember standing beside my sister once, and there was a guy she liked behind, and I'm like, Amy, look who's behind you. Like, just awful. Like, just awful. So we've encouraged our kids to just have healthy relationships with boys and girls, and to not make a big deal. Like, here's the interesting thing. Like, maybe I won't finish that sentence, but to know that crushes are going to happen. But I think they aren't a super big deal if you don't make them a super big deal. Like, do you have a crush on so-and-so? Just to let them be friends, and some friends are going to like more, and they're going to have feelings, and back and forth, and just to not have teasing be a part of the family culture, I think, is important. Thoughts, questions, feedback about this gender piece or the sex piece of boys and girls, men and women? We're going to talk about work, and we're going to talk about prayer, and then we got maybe some time to pray together even at the end, which would be really important. Any thoughts on this piece, though?
Not about the gender thing, but the dangerous play. That was actually taught when I went to school for my introductory to early childhood education to do that.
Like, to deliberately do that.
Let them climb the tree. Maybe don't let them go 50 feet up, but let them do that 20 feet up, or when the branches start getting a little weaker, stop. And like in our daycare, then we did do that. Like, we let our older kids climb that tree. A lot of us didn't like it at points because they'd start fighting in the tree, but...
But that's an important part of their development. Yeah. No, it certainly is.
And the worst part was when they climbed the tree to avoid their parents. But like, that was a thing, like, we were taught to do.
No,
for younger, for older, for...
It's very true. Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, it's just medically, scientifically, just... It's just common knowledge that's just what kids need. And they learn from their mistakes, right? And they learn when they're... I mean, we've had to take our kids to the hospital to get stitches when it was their own fault, and they don't get in trouble for that because the stitches are them getting in trouble for that, but we just, hey, you learn not to do that next time, and that's how you learn, and you know, you bump and you bruise, and God made kids' bodies flexible and generally healable, and that's how they learn. And yeah, it's important that we don't shield them from those really important opportunities to do that. Obviously, there's limits, and I think of course there are limits.
We need to discuss this. Yeah.
Yes, and we want to help them think through safety, right? So we want to help them. Yeah, of course. Let's talk about work here. In our modern culture, where thinking about urban dwellers in particular, I think kids who grow up on farms, this is not an issue for them because they're just working really hard from a young age. I assume, at least that's what everyone tells me. But in our modern, urban, comfortable lives, we have things so easy. I mean, we have vacuum cleaners and we have dishwashers and we have all this kind of stuff, and it is not as necessary for kids to be involved in doing chores. I mean, do you know why, you know, people 100 years ago had 13 kids?
There was that much work to do.
Yeah, there's work to do. We need some more helpers, you know? And today, we sort of swing the opposite way, not in terms of having less kids per se, but just think like, oh, maybe don't do that because you're not going to do as good of a job as I would, right? Isn't that one of the big reasons, kind of speaking honestly here, one of the big reasons why we don't get our kids involved in things more is because it's easier and quicker to do it ourselves and we can do a better job. And often, you know, when they get in there, it's going to take them longer, they're going to be messier, and all of that. And so it's just easier often for us and more convenient for us to do it ourselves. But what do our kids miss out on when we just do it all ourselves? What do they miss out on?
Learning how to
do those particular jobs? Absolutely. What else do they miss out on? What kind of, maybe even some character issues do they miss out on?
The responsibility of having, being in charge of doing something.
Right. I've given you a job to do.
Even if it's just cleaning out their little cubby on their desk or something. Look what I did. It looks nice, right?
Pride or self-confidence or something like that.
Sure, yeah.
Job well done,
absolutely. Responsibility is so huge, and you can't teach it without giving it. So responsibility is huge. Are there any others? I think laziness would be one, right? Or a work ethic. I hear people talk about this all the time, that kids these days don't have a work ethic. And I think there's probably something to that. And so we want to teach our kids how to work and how to work hard and how to use their time well and to steward their gifts well and to put some effort into something and to experience the benefits of that. And the only way that they're going to learn that is by us giving them that. And then this is not something you do with a four-year-old. I mean, maybe you do. With a four-year-old, it's a tiny little thing. But I think from 5 to 12 in this age group, particularly towards the 12, I think is entrusting to our kids greater and greater responsibilities and greater jobs. Teaching our kids not to complain about stuff. And to accept responsibility and to know that. Like, this is something I think Amy and I found ourselves slipping into at times where our kids were viewing work and even their schoolwork as something to get out of the way as quick as possible so that I can get back to playing, as if playing is the goal of life. And to help them see that, like, no, playing is good, and playing is an important part of childhood development. Free play is really important. Structured play is also important. For younger kids, structured play is, we're going to do this for 15 minutes and then we're going to do this. That's important, particularly for younger kids. Free play is also important, where they can just, you know, they can be bored. That's huge. Being bored is, I don't know if, Meg, if you learned this in your stuff, but that's like that's huge for a kid's brain to like not know what to do and have to figure out what to do. That's super important. That's one of the reasons iPads are so dangerous, is because they don't have the option of being bored. But to know that work is also really important, and that you know, if they lived on a farm 100 years ago, they wouldn't have near as much playtime as they have with us. And those are the people who built the modern world and won the world wars and went through the Depression. And, you know, like, I think it worked out okay for them. And so I think giving our kids chores, so much of this is actually, I think, more about us and us being patient with our kids and us being like, okay, I'll let you help with this. It's going to take longer. It's not going to be as neat and tidy, but this is good for you.
It's something that has to happen, right? Even if it's little pieces when they're little.
Yeah.
Because if they don't, you can't just pick it up when they're 12 and say, you need to do this.
Right.
If they get used to doing, whether it's taking the cutlery basket out of the dishwasher and emptying it, or maybe not the cutlery basket, that probably has sharp knives. You probably don't want to do that.
Take the knives out first. Yeah. But no, look for small ways. Melanie, I think that's really wise.
Because you can't just expect them when they're 13 to all of a sudden want to do all the jobs that you have for them if you've never involved them before that in some way.
I'll share just a couple of things just from my own personal experience. I think I realized I hadn't been doing this as well one time when I asked one of my kids to do a job and they asked how much they were going to get paid for it. And I think there was a little bit of a joke there. And so I just asked them, how much did you pay for the last meal that we gave you? Well, I didn't. Okay, who did? Well, you are part of this household. You are receiving great benefit. You're not paying anything for the food you eat, you know, all that. You can contribute to this home. You can help out. Yeah, that's just important for them to be contributors. It gives them a sense of actually being a part of the family and not just passive recipients. And so one of the things that when we got the thing in our mailbox that said they were looking for paper route deliverers, we jumped on it. And so this is something just recently, just starting in October, November, I'm doing a paper route with Judah. And I've been going with him much of the time to kind of teach him and set an example of how to work. And then I expect that to taper off and for him to be doing more and more of it himself. And learning how to work. It's a small thing, you think, you know, an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours in a week, but it's important. And one of the other benefits that comes with this is learning how to use money well. And maybe it's not just from working a paper route, but maybe it's, you know, all the Christmas money they get. Teaching our kids through this age group as they learn about money to how to prioritize that well, how to be generous, how to save, how to spend. I'm still figuring out healthy rhythms of doing this with our kids, but the work particularly when they're earning an income, even with the paper route, it is a great place to start training them early on how to do that. Given some of the things that we've just said, what do you think about the idea of giving kids an allowance in exchange for chores done around the house? So not an allowance in general, just here you get this much money a week but the idea of an allowance, particularly in response to chores around the house. What are some things that might be a good idea? What are some things there that might not be such a great idea?
Well, me and my husband, we are kind of the same way you guys are. We don't believe that children should get paid to do what they're expected to do in their home. And we've always felt that way. But we do allow our kids opportunities to choose, not without us telling them, to make a decision to choose to help work at the restaurant. And when they do, they get paid for said work. So kind of like the paper route for you. Because I think it's kind of like a false kind of thing when you pay them for that, because then you have like a resentful parents and stuff later because you figure that for that work you are owed something, when in reality you're not.
That's just,
you do that for free.
That's just what a home needs.
It's just what you do.
Right.
Yeah, so we don't want to like make them think that that's an appropriate standard. And then in turn making them, like giving them, but I found like giving them goals, things to work towards, so then it's like a motivator.
Right. So that's kind of where we've landed, but I think the what can be a benefit, and I think why some parents do this with the allowance, is it helps kids get their first experience of working for something, and to not just get a handout, but something that they actually worked for. And so I think if a parent decides, no, I'm not gonna pay them to clean their room or to take out the trash, that's just what you do as a member of this home, and your allowance is the food on your table, right? Like, that's my opinion, but I understand it's an opinion. If that's it, then to look for ways that you can teach them to earn an income through their work. And if there's not a, like, a family business is an awesome way of doing that, or a paper route, but if it's not that, are there other ways to encourage them to go, you know, offer to shovel people's yard or driveways for a fee, or to set up a lemonade stand, or things like that, where they are working and getting some money for that. I think as early as we can, not just because money's important, but that's just going to be a part of their life. So developing them early on with that is important.
I was listening to a podcast, and the guy was kind of talking about this, and he was saying that him and his wife didn't do an allowance, but what they did do was a game called Spot the Lie. And so how it worked was, anytime the kids saw something, like they're watching a movie or a TV show, or they read something on the newspaper or whatever, and they found a lie in there, so like, I don't know, pick an example. They go to the parents, they say, here's a lie, and this is why it's a lie, because the Bible says X, Y, and Z about it. And so for every time they did that, and of course there's a discussion with the parent too, like they ask some more follow-up questions, but they get a dollar if they are able to do
that. So I love the aspect of training your kids to be discerning about the things they're hearing. I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
Whether you attach money to it, I think we should all do that. Like, yeah. What do you think about this idea, guys? Do you see anything in there that seems to be not true? And yeah, teaching our kids to think critically is huge. Yeah. Teaching our kids to apply logic and that's all really huge. So we need to make wise decisions, and I think it could be appropriate for a family who maybe doesn't have the option of the family business or the paper route or something to do something with an allowance, and yet at the same time still help their kids understand that, look, you contribute as a part of your home. And so we have to be wise, but I think training our kids as they go through this age group, at this age period, training them to work is really important. And really easy to not do. It's quicker and easier to do it ourselves. And so I think that's where we parents need to put that to death. The last step I want to make tonight, and so much more we could have talked about, but it's just talking about praying by, or parenting by praying, and the idea that our kids are people. And we want to know them and know them individually and pray for them and their particular concerns, their particular needs, their particular growth areas that they need to grow in. All of that is just really key. And I was really challenged by that back in the summer when I was working through Paul Miller's book, A Praying Life. And what Paul Miller advocates for is not to use prayer lists, but to use 3.5-inch recipe cards and to just use prayer cards. The benefit of that is as you look at a card, that's all you're looking at. It's not like this huge, big, overwhelming list, and you're like, oh, you know, but you got a card, and that's all you're thinking of. And you might only spend a few seconds on each card, or some cards you might spend minutes on, but it's a helpful and a bit more of an easier to process way. And on that card, you can write a scripture, you can write prayer requests, you can add to it, and it becomes a personalized way of tracking prayer needs for that person. So I made prayer cards for each of my kids. And then that was quite a process to realize that I think when it came to their spiritual development, I'm just being honest here, in my head it was just sort of the kids. And I pray for them every night, Lord, help my kids to know you. Lord, help my kids to have soft hearts towards you. Help my kids to belong to you. But actually having a prayer card for each of them. Now thinking, Kate, Judah, Asher, Abigail, Lord, what do I need to pray for them as an individual on this day? Was quite a profound experience for me. Ted Tripp in Shepherding the Child's Heart gives three great questions to ask as we think about our kids. How are they relating to God? How are they relating to themselves? And how are they relating to other people? So what's their vertical relationship with God like? With themselves, are they understanding themselves? Or how are they growing in their sense of who they are and their place in this world? And then how are they doing with other people? And as we think about these three questions, God, myself, and others, as we think about that with our kids, there should be things that rise from there that become prayer concerns, and we pray earnestly for our kids. And this starts when your kids are really young. Like, help my kid to sleep through the night might be an early prayer request, or Lord, please help my 2-year-old to stop hitting other people or biting other kids in Sunday school. Like we should pray about those things. The Lord cares about those things. We should pray about them. But particularly as our kids get older and as they develop and mature, as their personalities come to the front, the issues become so much more complicated. And you begin to feel so much more overwhelmed. So overwhelmed. And I know so many times Amy and I just feel like, what are we even doing? And I think, as I've heard and listened to other parents, I think that's kind of normal. I think if you feel like you're on top of it, then maybe you're being unrealistic. And that sense of, Lord, what in the world is going on, drives us to pray. And so I think I want to encourage us to pray for our kids. I would love for us to pray here tonight as we end. And so just so you know, I'm going to, in a moment here, we're going to cut the tape and stop the recording and just spend a few minutes here with this group of people just praying for each other and praying for our kids. And we need the Lord so desperately. We need Him so bad. And I think that praying is where, so I've learned this from others, that praying is where some of our most important parenting happens. So we're going to do that here, and then we'll be back in a month to talk about biblical principles for raising children through the teenage stage.